This is Richard Burrow, continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project with Calixto Cabrera. Today is March 30th, 2006, and it's about 10:45 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, and Calixto, you're in Durango. Let's continue your story about these three portions of your life and your development post-Vietnam. And we were talking about kind of the drug side, that aspect of your life. Do you want to make some more comments about that?
I think what one of the things that really, you know, as I look back on it, one of the things that came out of the whole drug experience for me, which was very much mingled with the political experience, because I felt that, at least in the beginning of my participation, both in the usage of and the sales of drugs, that it was a very revolutionary act, that I was finding a way to circumvent the system, that I was undermining the government in my own small way. And what I mean by that was that I was helping an underground structure to exist and thrive in this country to the degree that I could. And I looked upon that underground structure as a base platform from which to launch a possible revolution in this country, which I thought was coming. And I fully intended to be a participant. One of the things I used to do was I would drive around, and every now and then I would either see undercover cops, or I would see a cop driving his or her personal vehicle. As it turns out, primarily it was guys. And I would write down their license numbers with the intention of finding the houses for possible future assassinations to take out law enforcement, because I knew that's who I was going to be battling, type of thing. Okay. And the reason I say this is because, again, it speaks to the state of mind. I had so much hate in my heart for the system. I was hurting. I didn't really want to consciously look at the concept of I'm hurting because of the things that I've done in the war. So that was too uncomfortable and too painful for me to delve into. It was more like, I hate them for using me. This is a corrupt system. I mean, I just started using all these adjectives about the system, the president, and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. When the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army, kidnapped Patricia Hearst, I knew that I wanted in. I actively started seeking them out. It was ironic because the FBI came to my house. I wasn't there, but they questioned Bill Unger and Tricia. Actually, I think just Tricia was there, mm-hmm. and she said, well, they're not here, and I don't know anything about it, you know, one of those kind of things. But they were questioning all people that they had on their files as radicals, political radicals, about this whole SLA thing. And I didn't really know anything about it, but I wanted to find them. I knew that this was a group I wanted to join, and I was just devastated when they were with that shootout in L.A. where they ended all being, you know, being killed.
Right.
I got on the phone. I was actually in the I think I was in the Santa Monica office of VVAW, and I called my brother in New York. Now, my brother, he's non-political, and if anything, he maybe had some sympathies going with the government or pro-war sympathies or anything like that, but he and I were tight. You know, he has since passed on. He was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was 53, but at the time, I mean, that was his space, so I called him up, and I told him that a bunch of friends of mine had just been murdered. Now, I know that the phone, the Santa Monica phone, is tapped. It's tapped 24/7 by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know they're listening. And, you know, I just used it to send them a message that, you know, their time was coming and I was going to be on the other side. I was crying and telling my brother that that they had killed some friends of mine. And yeah, I'm not sure he quite knew what to do with all of this. He said he was sorry to hear it. And he kind of just flowed with me. But it was more a message for the feds to know my mind space and that they really did have an enemy on their hands here. So
this was these were purposeful kind of revolutionary acts against the government in the ways that you knew how to do, basically.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I don't, you know, also for the record, though, I don't agree with when the SLA killed that Marcus whatever professor, that was their first killing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't agree with that at all. And as it turns out, they later on said that they had made a big mistake, that the guy ended up being a liberal on campus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but they murdered him. Anyway, to me it was more that they were striking out against the system, and then they started the bank robberies and all things that those things I supported. I guess, you know, if you're a revolutionary, you got to get money and guns somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And the banks have the money. It's the place to go. But again, I talk about this then because it was just my head and my heart were hurting, and I was angry, and I was violent. I had a great potential for violence. I was still this walking time bomb. And I had an enemy. You know, when you put those three things together, I'm surprised I didn't go shoot some cop somewhere. I really am. There was an incident, so to speak, at UC Irvine in Irvine, California, because that's part of Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
Where I needed to go to the school, I was going to go do something or other, and I was carrying a gun at the time with me. And
what kind of gun? It was a handgun, I think.
Yeah, it was a handgun. Yeah.
Okay.
And I pulled into this parking spot, and this shithead off-duty cop pulls in, saying that I'm not supposed to be parking there because he wanted the parking, you know, that he was coming here and that he had seen the spot first and blah blah blah, and told me to get out. And I thought of shooting him right on the spot. I kept going back and forth with this, and I'm going, you know, is this fuckhead worth it or not? I said, no, he's not. I think what I'll do is just beat the living shit out of him. And I know I'm going to be arrested, but I'm going to set this up so that, you know, minimum amount of time and this and that. And I didn't want to be caught with that gun. So I pull out of the parking spot, and I go park where he said I'm supposed to be parking, and I realize that student parking where I was visitor parking. He's a student. I'm a visitor. He's the one that's parked in the wrong spot and made me get out. And that just really just kind of just, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the final straw. I turned around and just found a spot in there, left the gun in the car, and I just ran after this guy. Just he disappeared on me.
Hmm.
He had gotten away. But my hate, my anger, and my rage was going to be vented on this one cop. And he picked the wrong person, the wrong place and time, and it was beautiful because of his error, that telling me that that's not that's student parking. Now I'm a visitor and get my butt on over to the other side and blah blah blah.
Right.
So that even though his fellow cops may not like it, he was dead wrong, even to them. You know,
mm-hmm.
He got away from me. I went into two or three buildings looking for this guy, and he was the one I was going to take it out on. He doesn't know to this day how close he came. to really being hurt, because I was really going to cut loose on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God it didn't happen. It didn't happen.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, how you feel about that now, looking back.
You're
thankful
thank
you didn't go there.
Yeah, thank God it didn't happen. That's all I can say. I still have a problem with cops who abuse their authority and stuff like that. But but at the same time, I found myself at the other end of the spectrum, because in 2002, with the Missionary Ridge fires here in Durango, I'm a member of the Red Cross, and I have been for about 15 years or so. I was a shift manager at one of the shelters up in Bayfield, or the shelter up in Bayfield. And I had the, I think it was 4 to midnight shift. And on my shift around 10 o'clock at night, there was one officer on duty there. And he was a marshal. And I was outside. He and I were talking when he got a call in that said that he had, that there were people on the grounds there of the school. Because we had the shelter full of people, and then we had all kinds of people camping on the ground so that they could have access to food and stuff like that. And that they were drunk and rowdy and blah, blah, blah. And so this guy said, okay, and he called in for backup, and there was no backup. All police forces were stretched thin because of the fires. And I could see this guy. I kind of looked at him because, you know, I heard him call and I heard the response. And I could see his mind going that he was not happy about going over there alone to deal with this thing. And seemed like a nice guy. So I said to him, you want me to, you know, want me to go on over there with you? And he was kind of a, you know, he was a nice guy, but he's also kind of, you know, macho cop kind of thing. And he said, you know, it wasn't like, yeah, I'd appreciate it or something like that. I was like, if you want, you know, that type of thing, like a cavalier answer. But I could tell that he really didn't want to go over there alone. And there was a slight sense of relief that somebody was willing to go with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I went with him, and these people were total assholes, all but one.
Mm-hmm.
Total ass, drunk on their ass. And, you know, he was polite and respectful, but he told them if he had to come back, he was going to write him a citation. But, and one of them in particular started getting verbally abusive, and I wasn't sure if it was going to come down to this guy's going to have to make an arrest here. And if so, no telling what happened, because, you know, there's like 4 or 5 of these guys. And, two of them kind of just like, blah, 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 and they start walking in a circle type of thing. And so I backed up the officer. I kept an eye on the two on the back. And I kind of, it was just a sense of telling myself that, you know, this cop and I are going down together if we go down, because I'm not going to let them get to him. And it was like I had drawn a line, and it was a line on the side of the police, you know, or at least that police officer. And I just kind of like the irony of it all. It's like I come full circle.
Mm-hmm.
So now I just, you know, just like Martin Luther King says, you know, I judge them by the content of their character as versus the color of the uniform.
Right. How long did it take you to get there when you had that attitude?
That took even longer than healing from the whole Vietnam thing. Because it's been really hard to get over my dislike of authority, the authorities and the cops in particular. But I'd say it was a process. It wasn't, you know, any one point, but I'd say that I probably crossed the mark at about the 25-year mark or so, 25, 26 years. Well, I started looking at them more as people instead of, you know, the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So that one took a little longer.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to go into as far as this aspect of your post-Vietnam life?
Just that the other thing, to me, there were things that I did that I consider outlaw. And then there were things that I did that I considered criminal, you know,
right.
And I consider them very different kinds of things. The outlaw existence is one in which I refuse to adhere to the rules and regulations created by an arbitrary bunch of, you know, old timers that are just, most of which are corrupt. I'm talking about Congress, the executive, and the Senate, and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Where criminal is really an act that it could have been revolutionary if it was part of a revolutionary movement. It was something done to a purpose. But when it's done for the sake of money, or if it's done for the sake of anger with no thought, then that's more criminal. And to me, assaulting that guy was criminal, and an extortion that I pulled I don't remember if it was a Safeway or it was a supermarket and I don't even remember the name of the town, maybe Compton or something like that in California.
Mm-hmm.
But it was myself and these two other guys. We just kind of cased the place, followed the manager home, got the address, you know, the home location, the address of the manager and stuff like that. And then I called in, you know, asked for him and used my deepest, most intimidating voice that I could, and said that we had placed a bomb in his house, and I gave him the you know, his own address and stuff like that, so he knew that I'd been there, and that we wanted some money, put it in the thing, and that there were actually two bombs, one in his house and one in the store itself. Packaged in a manner that looks like, you know, it's a product on the shelf, and that I will tell him where both of them are at.
Mm-hmm.
As long as he pays up. And this guy did. He just took a bag of money and he dropped it where we told him to, and we grabbed the money and just disappeared into the night, so to speak. As it turns out, that guy was investigated later on. I mean, because the whole thing came down, they checked into it, and he was fired, not because of that incident, but apparently he'd been kind of siphoning some funds off of the store himself. It's one of those things that, again, it bothers my conscience. Wish I hadn't done it. But wishing doesn't change the circumstances, and wouldn't do it again. I'm pretty sure that the guys that that I worked with, and I no longer remember their names, but I think they tried it again two or three more times. I bailed on it. I didn't want anything anymore to do with it. But
did they make it? Were they successful?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think things went wrong each time because I wasn't that much in communication with them. Just a little bit, and every now and then that I would run into them or something. They kind of mentioned something or other that led me to believe that they tried several more times and were unsuccessful. So,
where did you go from there?
Well, I, you know, as when it came to things that number one brought a lot of heat down versus, you know, drug dealing where you just have to be on guard 24/7, but it's not like the police are mobilizing to go there for any specific incident and looking for you in particular. The things that drew a lot of heat, I just kind of started backing off of those kinds of things because I kept thinking that, you know, just, you know, getting too old for this stuff, I'm not very much made to, for the prison life. And there's a potential for somebody getting hurt. And that somebody, you know, could be me or it could be somebody else. And I just wasn't at the point where I just wanted people to be hurt anymore by anything that I did. When I got out of the drug industry, I do believe that I had mentioned the portion where I had been ripped off and that I lost 3-4 kilos of cocaine. I don't remember what it was now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, not kilos, pounds. But what bothered me about that whole incident was that the woman that lived with her daughter in the house above, I had a little room on the bottom, which was what I was using in a storage. You know, I kept thinking, what would have happened if her and her daughter happened to come home doing this ripoff? And it's like, I didn't want, you know, she was a friend of mine, and I really liked her daughter, and I didn't want to go there thinking about that. Of course, I kept thinking about it, that my conscience would have been, you know, really bothered had they been hurt or killed during this ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that that if I was going to continue doing this kind of stuff, that I had to have it set up where nobody was involved but me, you know?
Yeah.
So that, you know, if there's any consequences to pay, I pay them, but nobody else gets hurt. So that was a further withdrawal from the, maybe another way to put it is that I started off with, I'll sell anybody drugs 24/7. Just give me a call. And people did, you know, and I'd get a call at 2 or 3 in the morning. Somebody wants some pot or a gram of coke or something like that. And it was just, after a while it was, no, we're going to have to do some kind of working hours here. And then after a while it was, well, you know what? I don't like this. I'm watching and studying how people get busted. And the phone is one of the major no-nos. I don't want any more drug conversations over the phone. We need to create a more clandestine setup to communicate and to meet. And then after that it was, no, you don't bring anybody else, especially strangers, to pick up anything at my place. And then after that it was, no, you don't come to my place anymore. We go meet on neutral ground somewhere. Because I don't want people knowing where I'm at. And then after that it was, you know what, I'm not even comfortable with people knowing my name. Other people that I started meeting, I started using another name. And after that it was like, you know what, they're still calling my house and my phone number. There's still too much information here for the police. So I think I'm going to get an answering service, and they can call, you know, under that false name, and let them call there so that if the police track it, they track it to a dead end point. So I kept going more and more underground as time went on, and as I continued to study and analyze the situation around me. And concurrent to that entire process, I was getting a little more disgusted with a lot of, I'm not going to say all of them, but a lot of the people that I was working with. You know, they would be good for a while, and then they'd screw up, or they'd take a loss and think it's somehow I'm supposed to take the loss because they took the loss. In the meantime, I'm paying my people the complete amount because I can't pass my losses on to them. And not to mention that, you know, the lies and the bullshit and the flimsy excuses. I just got more and more tired of people in the drug industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that final loss came, which was the one with the woman and lived with the with a young girl, I called my contact and I said, look, you know, this is what happened. And, I had bought a mini mall, in Northern California, up around Cool, California. And, I told the guy, I owed him about $300,000 is what it came down to based on the loss. And I said, I'm just going to give you this thing, to make up for the loss. Cause I knew I was pulling out, and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. And, he said, no, I'm not accepting that thing. You have to work this off. And I said, okay. And that was his mistake, because I hung up the phone and I moved. And not that he knew where I lived anyway, but I moved. And he, like everybody else, had a false name for me and had a false phone number and blah blah blah. So he could have been paid, but he chose to insist that I stay in the industry and work that debt off, and so he lost.
Okay.
And at that point, I was almost as heartsick about being in the drug industry as I had been about being in the Marine Corps and needing to get out. So I needed to get out of both of them really bad. And I did. I just walked from that whole experience. Throughout this whole period of time, mind you, I'm having these spiritual experiences, so to speak.
Right.
Awakenings.
Can you describe?
And insights.
What were they like?
Well, I guess it's a perfect segue to go into that at this point. To reference my spiritual experience, I really have to go back to my childhood again, just to remind you about a couple of things. I grew up in a household where they did seances.
Right.
And so, and in these seances, it was either my grandmother who was the channel, or it was this friend of the family named Don Cecilio. Mm-hmm. And but since, you know, I knew both of them very well, when we did the seances and their personality changed, the change was so big and so profound that I knew, for instance, especially in reference to my grandmother, I knew that that's not my grandmother talking anymore. I don't know who's in the driver's seat, but it's not grandma, you know. Mm-hmm. And usually the circumstances for the necessity of the seance was that somebody was or other was doing something bad to the family. You know, people in the family were getting sick. Just not good things were going on. And with so many of these things, I always wondered why, a lot of people must not like us because somebody's always sending something our way or other. And it ended up, it didn't end up, but just the one that really stands out was the one where the guy doing the channel at the time, who I don't remember who it was, went and showed this pearl that had been hidden in the house, and I talked to you way back when about that, so that's on the record.
Yes.
But I guess what this did for me, the mindset that it created was that I grew up very accepting of the reality of non-corporeal existence. And even on this plane, I'm not just talking about, oh, somebody dies, they go to the great beyond. We really don't know shit about them after that. It's the ones that don't go to the great beyond and hang here on Earth. So I knew that this kind of stuff, I just accepted it, that it was, this is the way it is, this is life. So I was rather, but all of that was pretty scary because I was pretty young and it was pretty scary, and my brother didn't like it, and my cousins didn't like it. None of us liked it. We had to kind of like sit there where all of this, you know, shenanigans went on with the adults. But I grew up with an acceptance of this kind of phenomena exists. Mm-hmm. And I kind of since my family certainly weren't practicing Catholics. For all practical purposes, Catholicism was the main influence in their lives, religiously speaking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Catholicism doesn't condone seances and stuff like that. It's the devil's work and all that other crap. So it was an influence, and I grew up saying, I'm Catholic, you know, because I didn't know what else to say. And I accepted that. So these were the influences that molded my spiritual awarenesses for that period of time. Mm-hmm. I had a real problem. With Catholicism, I used to, even as a kid, I concluded that it didn't make sense to me that this whole thing about going to hell, mm-hmm. that if you sinned for a human lifetime could be anywhere from 70 to 100 years, maybe 110 tops. Mm-hmm. It's less than a microsecond of space-time when compared to an eternity. And here we are, for a microsecond of space-time, we have sinned, we're going to hell for all eternity. It seemed to me very unjust. And this was as a child I was thinking about this, and so I was questioning the tenets of Catholicism then. Now I don't buy them at all. But it was a rocky road for me when it came to trying to be a Catholic. It was not a good thing.
Yeah.
I was baptized when I was around 12 in the church, and because, you know, most of the time they do it as babies, and, you know, put you through the line, put a little water on you. Because I was 12, I had to go study I had to take a study course. About the various prayers, and I had to learn all these questions, and I studied diligently for about 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks, I think it was. And then I was told I was going to be asked some questions by the priest. And then, on the day of my baptism, I went through the whole line, and I'm thinking about all this stuff and all these answers. And when I come up to the priest, he just kind of like, blah, 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 Spirito Santo and this and that, poured a little water, and boom. I left the church so pissed. I was just like, what kind of crap is this? I had to do all that studying for that.
Yeah.
You know, it was so the whole church thing just didn't work for me at all. And then somewhere along the line, especially after Vietnam, I wasn't very religious, and I certainly didn't pay any attention whatsoever. You know, once I left the house, I had nothing to do with seances or anything like that, because I never liked them anyway. Had that, you know, got shot up, near-death experience in Vietnam, that the main one in the rice paddy.
Right.
But after I got out of the service, I ended up getting into radical politics and met a bunch of atheists and started studying Marx and Mao in particular, and religion is the opiate of the masses, and so I just kind of gave up on religion and spiritual beliefs altogether and just became a practical Marxist, you know, mm-hmm. At least for a while. But I found that I have always been an extreme sci-fi buff, mm-hmm. major Trekkie to this day. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I started picking up some books. So most of the books that I was reading were sci-fi, and sci-fi, the thing about sci-fi is you have to have imagination, you know, because it takes you to some strange places. And I found myself picking up also books about out-of-body experiences. Mm-hmm. And from the out-of-body experiences, I started picking up some books about, channel. And channeling and channels started to become vogue for a while. Mm-hmm. In particular, Ramtha. You were hearing about Ramtha left and right, and especially in the community that I hung in, and what he did, and Jay-Z Knight was the channel there. So since I had awarenesses of channelings and channels, I started reading a little bit about Ramtha, but his messages were always very, very loving, and they spoke about the spirit world and this and that. So I kind of gave up the whole atheist thing and just decided to become an agnostic, because it was less dogmatic, and I was at least open to possibilities. Mm-hmm. And kept doing my readings and kept hearing about channels. And somewhere along the line, I started saying to myself, I would like to. I'm sorry, did you say something?
No.
Somewhere along the line, I said to myself, I would like to study under a channeled master. And in particular, just a channeled master. I didn't want to study under somebody who I consider enlightened, and the person that's coming to mind right off my mind is Ram Dass. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want a person. I wanted the person to be just channeling energies. And I did. I found this, one day my now ex-wife, mm-hmm. Susan, I had been living with her. I was a roommate of hers. We became roommates because I needed a place in Orange County. I was living in Northern California, but I was coming down to Orange County often enough where I knew that I needed a room somewhere. And my friend Richard knew Susan. I met Susan through Richard, and we talked a few times, and I asked her if she wanted to rent me a room for whenever I was in town. And she needed the money, and she said yes, and she had this cute little baby girl named Amber, who is now my adopted daughter. Mm-hmm. And I really liked Amber, and so I took the room. At some point thereafter, Susan came to me, or maybe even before that, we had already become friends. It may have been prior to my moving in with her. She came up to me in downtown Laguna. I ran into her, and she said, I heard of this this lady is starting some channeling classes up in Orange. Her name is Ann Fisher. And I said, let's go. Mm-hmm. So we did. Later on that week, we went and actually ended up to be the second group. She had already started one group. We were the second group that showed up. We ended up, the moniker for that process that we ended up with was called the teachings. It just kind of evolved out of what was going on. We didn't know how else to address it. Mm-hmm. The teachings, I was in the teachings for about 6 years, give or take a little bit. And I had some of the most profound spiritual experiences in there. The beings that were channeled were the Master Serapis. That was the primary being. She channeled several of them. Mm-hmm. Let me see. The Master Serapis, the Lord Johann. Some of these other guys' names. There was about four or five. But it may come to me later. Master Serapis was the main one. And ironically, I taped a lot of those classes, and all of those tapes have disappeared on me.
Really?
Yeah, all of them. But one of the first, I had gone to about two or three of the classes. So we may have been into class four or class five, whatever. And, you know, the being had started talking, and I forget what all, what direction we were receiving, but we ended up doing a meditation. And I started, you know, as usual, I started seeing an M16 and then blah, 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 and all these visions of Vietnam. And I kind of just started quietly crying. So the being was going around, finally came to me, and I talked to him, you know, explained a little bit about the whole Vietnam thing. And I had a media, a set of, you could have a private session with the channel or with the being, because it would be a channeled session. I was scheduled for a session the following morning, because I was living in Northern California. It was like, I think it would be like Tuesday nights would be the group set up, and then Wednesday mornings private sessions. So I would always set up for a private session Wednesday morning, do the group thing Tuesday night. So they said, you know, he said, I'm going to see you tomorrow, so we'll talk more about it then. So the next day we did, and in the meditation, we did a meditation again, and in the meditation, the being said, or rather, I did a meditation. He guided me through a meditation. I say he because the energy of the Master Seraph, even though Ann Fisher was the channel, the Master, the energy being put forth by the Master Seraph, this was male energy.
Okay.
So you can kind of distinguish that this was a kind of a male persona coming through. I did this meditation, and what I came to the realization was, it was just like, all of a sudden, it's just like, oh, no. I realized that I had done and been, I had done this warrior thing lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. I have no idea how many lifetimes I've either been a soldier, been some kind of a warrior, you know, a samurai, a this or a that, and countless lifetimes I've either killed or been killed, you know, doing these roles. And it was just, when I realized that I'd been doing this for so long, it just broke my heart. It was just like, I couldn't deal with it, and I just started crying and crying and crying. And
let me ask, how did you know this? What was it that really made this real for you?
It was like I saw it. I was in this meditation, and I was deep into the meditation, and all of a sudden it's like an awareness that just bubbles up out of somewhere, but it's very consuming. Mm-hmm. And it's just all of a sudden, it's knowingness. You know, I reach a state of knowingness about something that I had participated in. And the thing about knowingness is, there's no way to prove this. There's no factual data that I can lay down in front of you so you can put it under the microscope and analyze it and come to the same conclusion. It's like, all of a sudden, I know this is what I've been doing lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. The being confirmed that for me and said that I needed these journeys. I needed to do these journeys. And he said, and then we specifically spoke about the people that I had killed in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And again, the Master Serapis said that that for my spiritual evolution in this lifetime, I needed to kill these people. Well, actually, let me take a step back first. He said that prior to my entry into this incarnation, that I had a soul agreement with these beings that I had murdered, that for my spiritual evolution in this lifetime, I needed to kill these people. For their spiritual evolution in this lifetime, they needed to be killed by me. And there was just a resonance. That sounded right to me. I don't know why. It sounded like I had just heard truth. And I cried a little more, and, you know, we kind of did some kind of like prayers and meditations and just kind of wrapped it up. Well, I went back home, home being Northern California, later on that day, and from the airport, I was driving. A bridge had gone down because of some floods, and a dike broke up there. A bridge got swept away, so what is normally a 10 or 15 minute drive from the airport to my house was now like a 45 or 50 minute drive.
Right.
So I'm driving home from the airport, and I'm thinking about all of this stuff that had happened during the day with the master therapist. And as I'm driving along, you know, it's like pitch black out there type of thing, country road. It's like something just set in into my heart. It just went in, and this small washing of my heart, and it was just this very, very peaceful, loving energy. And it was just like I said, wow, I really do feel better about this. And the about this thing was that I have been walking around this whole time since Vietnam up to that point, thinking that I was lower than an animal. That, you know, how could I have done that? Some of these things, you know, some of these murders and the destruction and the blah, blah, blah. Even under the guise of patriotism and defense of country and all this stuff, those words were just so hollow at that point. And I just thought that I was lower, some kind of deviant life form, much lower than the animal kingdom. And all of a sudden, I felt better about that, that I wasn't that deviant life form, that this had been a spiritual agreement between myself and these other beings that I ended up murdering in this lifetime. Or even the assaults and stuff like that, even for the ones that I didn't kill, you know, that all of this was, you know, we just had an agreement. We're going to play this thing out on the earth plane. And we did. So I kind of considered that my first healing, because of it kind of removed this picture of I'm just such a low life form, you know. I'm subhuman. I'm subhuman is what it amounts to. And that was the first one that I put down, and I still remember that washed feeling over my heart. It was really wonderful.
What year was this? Where are we chronologically?
I would say this is early 80s somewhere, okay. Early to mid 80s. Probably closer to mid-80s. And again, the teachings ended up being this really... one of the ways I used to describe the teachings was that if you took some of the greatest sci-fi minds in the world, put them in a room all together, and told them, come up with something really strange and different... they wouldn't even come close to some of the stuff that went on in the teachings. You know, some of the awarenesses and some of the experiences that we had, because Vietnam was major profound experience number one on the earth plane for Calixto. Mm-hmm. The teachings was major profound experience on the earth plane for Calixto number two, and in its own right, it may have been more profound. Actually, I would say not may have been; it was more profound than Vietnam for me. Certainly, insofar as the awarenesses I had, the healings that I had, and I'm still undergoing, and the impact that it had on my life overall, and in my, on my view of how I view life, period. You know? So I look at Vietnam as a teaching in its own right, as both the most horrible experience I've had on the earth plane, and at the same time an incredible gift from God, because without my having undergone the whole Vietnam thing, I would have not had that, you know, I'm a subhuman type of feeling. It would not have put me on a path for, you know, self-actualization is really what it came down to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at Vietnam as a great gift, both from God to me and from me to myself, type of thing.
Yeah.
So that view in itself is a healing for me.
Being able to realize that.
Yeah. Being able to give some perspective to it. Once upon a time, I was lost in the middle of it. Then I experienced the regret in its aftermath, the regret of having participated in and done these things. And now as I've gotten older and I'm up the road, I can put it into some perspective in my life, that it really had a place and a space and a time, and that it was to a purpose. It was specifically to kick myself in the ass, to start seeking some answers for how I could do the things that I did over there, and to get some perspective. One of the other things in another session in the teachings, well, actually, as part of this one here, having realized that I had participated in these murders life after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, I also know that for me, that I have broken the cycle in this life, that I don't need this kill or be killed process anymore. Whatever purpose it has been serving for my soul, it's done. It's a done deal, and I don't need to do that anymore. So,
what was it that gave you the strength to break the cycle?
I think that my strength came from the anguish that I felt about having done the things that I did. And knowing that I needed some kind of, it was the process. I needed reconciliation. I didn't know it at the time that I needed reconciliation. I didn't even know it was possible. I also didn't know at the time that, I mean, I feel the way I feel. I think the way I think. Of course, there's no way out of this. You can't do anything about this. This is just the way it is. And it turns out that's not the case at all. And, you know, I want to reiterate that this is one of the gifts that I'm hoping that somebody out there, if they ever come upon this, takes from this chronology of life experiences that I've been putting on this the recording, is that however painful the experience was, or is, maybe it could be a very present tense thing for them. It just seems like there's no way out, no doors, no one can help. This is a pain in the heart. It has nowhere to go. And while that's true in the sense that that's what it seems like at the moment, it's not true from the perspective of, if you want an end to this, and I don't mean suicide as an end, I mean there's a path and a way out of it all. It's been created by God. All I have to do is find it and walk it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether it was, you know, carnage and war or a rape or something that you saw or betrayal, whatever. You know, we're really talking about trauma and healing from trauma. What the trauma is irrelevant. What the experience tells me is that there is no trauma that is not healable. None. And I remember a little, actually, you were talking to Bonnie, my wife. Mm-hmm. And because of your particular work, you have heard an incredible amount of stories. And you had mentioned to her that some of the things that I had that I had mentioned to you were quote not even that bad compared to some of the stuff that you've heard. And I let that flow through me for a while, and I realized that certainly certainly must be true, at least for you. And at the same time, I started thinking about just the nature of trauma, and that that trauma is a thing and a process that's so very personal to us that it's not you know, it has nothing to do with comparisons and magnitudes. It's got to do with how the person feels. And that for me, that those things were devastating, but that I may speak to some vets who, and already have, to some vets who have done things that went far beyond anything I did. And all I can imagine is that I don't know if their trauma is in fact deeper in the psyche than mine was. As a matter of fact, I don't see that the whole comparison thing does much good at all anyway, because trauma is very personal. It's extremely personal, and it just really doesn't matter what the trauma was. It's the fact that the word applies to the individual, and that individual needs help. And it has hopefully prepared me. That ended up being a reminder to me that I am going to talk to more vets at different points in time, and that I have done this comparison thing in the past with, you know, somebody said blah 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 blah, and I'm thinking that, oh man, you have no idea, you know, in my own mind, I haven't necessarily verbalized it, but I said in my own mind, you have no idea, you know, how hard life can really be. You know, this stuff you're talking about is, you know, is petty ass shit. And I my realization is that, boy, that I really need to watch myself, because that is just so not true. I mean, it's true for me when I do the comparison thing, but it's not going to be true for that person. And I need to walk a fine line with that and just stay with where they're at with their process. That's all. Yeah. That's what I've learned from that experience, and that was a good teaching for me.
So it sounds like one of these lessons or one of these things that's come to you is everybody's trauma is their own trauma, and it affects everybody individually, whether it's something small according to someone else or huge according to someone else. And each person needs to approach it in their own way, on their own, in their own time. Is that kind of what, is that a good summarization?
That's perfect. That's perfect. I hit it right on the nail. And, you know, even that's a teaching in its own right, you know, because it helps alter the way that I will interact with my fellow human beings out there when they relate their tales or talk about something that disturbs them or that they've been traumatized about. In the teachings has been an incremental process of change for me, because there's no way, even in another 20 hours, I can't remember everything that went on in the teachings. Things will come as time goes on that I remember occurred while or were influenced by the teachings, but it was just so much stuff. And like I said, over 6 years, a lot of the things that the beings talked about was that we create our own reality. We came down here to have a series of experiences. That first of all, we chose the Earth plane because Earth has a unique combination of components that will allow us the ability, if we choose, when we're here, because we can change our minds as we walk the path down here, but it has these unique components that will allow us to maximize a spiritual experience down here that will allow us, that has the setup that we can utilize a lot of what is available on Earth to have our experiences and be able to heal from them if we choose. And now that is now my belief system, and one of the healing and liberating components of that is that I have maximum responsibility for my choices in life and the consequences thereof. What it has done for me as the beings would put it, that I am Lord and Master of all life processes. And that what that means is, I mean, if you take the example of Jesus, he was somebody who walked the earth plane as a human being, realized that there was more to life than just these, you know, mundane, everyday things that human beings do, started a search for that, found his own enlightenment, realized that he could do, that in essence, that he's like a wizard, has the powers of a wizard, or, you know, something way beyond. He can alter physical matter or not, you know. But he wasn't caught up in with the, I want to put on a show, let me alter physical matter for everybody. It's like, I'm a spiritual being having a physical experience or a human experience, but I cannot forget that my roots are that I am a spiritual being, that I've come down here to see how I react to all this external stimuli that I'm receiving in the earth plane, and what choices I make in relationship to that, and can I keep in mind that I was born to a purpose and that I have a mission here. Can I keep the focus of that, or will I lose focus and, I don't know, go get a harem and have 40 kids and aspire to just be wealthy and that's it, you know, because these kinds of things happen down here and we get lost in that cycle pretty easily. Because it's an enticing process down here.
Well, and let me ask you this. What would you say to somebody who listens to this or has a conversation with you or others who believe this and just simply doesn't buy it? Is that part of, you know, what I said about trauma? What you've been saying is that, you know, each individual's reality is each individual's reality, period.
You know, it's very simple. Let me buy this. I've already encountered people like that where I've kind of told some of my story. They give me some respect from the perspective of that I shared something intimate with them, but they don't necessarily buy the process. There's nothing whatsoever that I can do for these people. All I can do is impart what I experienced, how it came about, what I walked away with because of it. The reason we spent about 20 hours now doing this build-up is because I wanted to give people a reference mind state for who I was, where I came from, what I ended up being, and ultimately how much hate I had in my heart. And how I have, what has transpired since then that allowed me to find a way to walk away from all that hate and start taking people, you know, as one-on-one and judging them by the content of their character. And even more so, just to understand that I have chosen all of these experiences. This is a leap of faith that I have undergone. And faith and facts don't necessarily mix. People who are looking for facts, this is not their story. However, I would find it interesting that somehow, some way, in some manner, they found their way to this story. And I suspect that that's not an accident. They might say, oh, this is bullshit, you know, I mean, this guy's all wet or something or other. Right then, 25 years later, they may remember some of the things that they heard on this recording that they played about, you know, this guy and how he ended up healing from this trauma. And it may have a lot more significance to them at that point in time. Mm-hmm. If they find their way to the recording, there's a reason for it. What they conclude from it will be, you know, it will be up to them. But this is also... And not, I'm not doing this to try and convince anybody about anything.
Of course.
I'm sharing. And they will walk away with whatever they choose to walk away with. And, you know, the practical and the scientific will have 1,000,000,000 punch holes that they can do into this thing from their perspective. And so be it. But I don't live for their perspectives. I live for mine. And again, so I tell my story. Those events were kind of the beginning of the kind of like a precursor to deeper healings that I underwent while I was in the teachings. And not just as an active member of the teachings, being in the teachings, but I left the teachings after about 6 years. With my the spiritual door once opened, it's a one-way path. There's no, like, for instance, I can't go back to being an atheist. There's just no way on this beautiful earth that I can do that. I have a profound belief in God and the multitude of emissaries that he has sent down here at different points in time, Jesus just being one of them. Buddha was certainly one of them. Mohammed appears to be one of them. Admittedly, I don't know a whole heck of a lot about Mohammed, but he seems to have had a great impact in the Middle East. And there are others, a lot of others. So all of these people attained enlightenment on this realm in physical bodies. They underwent the same or similar challenges that we went. They just happened to have seen through the smoke screen that those challenges represented and saw beyond that. And it was their salvation. I envy them. I wish to. I am in my own way emulating them. I hope to. Probably not in this lifetime, but who knows? Certainly, some other lifetimes. I hope to attain Christ consciousness on my own, because I am every bit as much a child of God as was Jesus, or as was any of these other beings that we're talking about, or anybody else that's walking the earth for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as prodigy of the same creation, we all have the same powers and abilities. It's just latent within us, dormant, until we choose to awaken them, and that's a process. You know, it just doesn't happen. You don't snap your finger and it happens.
So without the Vietnam War, this awakening would not have happened.
I seriously doubt that it would have happened. I think I would have been into my old age before I start getting the wisdom that I needed to start thinking about a spiritual path. I was too much. I grew up in a ghetto where you know, money and the chicks are it. Beyond that, well, there is nothing beyond that. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't. It was a way of accelerating my awakening on this plane for me. And that's how I look upon it.
Mm-hmm.
I continued to do the teachings. We did many ceremonies. One of the ceremonies we did was called the Ascension of the Lord Chohan to be something or other. I don't know, kind of like keeping an eye on the evolution of the earth plane. So this Lord Chohan being kind of got a promotion, so to speak. When we did that ceremony, one of the things that we did was we were all sitting back to back, and we put our hands on top of each other's shoulders in a meditative process. And it was like somebody turned on the electric switch. It's like all of a sudden I felt rivers of energy running through my body. It was just like, it was all I could do to hold on, so to speak, as this energy poured through me. And it was, when we finished and I kind of put my hands down, I realized that I was exhausted, just exhausted from what had happened. And I could barely hold my hands up, just barely hold my hands up. And that's just one of those off-the-wall little things that happened there. As I continue to go to the teachings and the process progressed, I also started reading a book called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of these Christed beings that walk the earth that nobody ever knows about, especially Christianity doesn't know about them because they're very focused on Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not a bad thing, to be focused on Jesus. If you want to be focused on anybody, that's a good one. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But I read his book, and I was so taken by his love of God. I've never read a book about anybody who expresses love of God, one so eloquently and two so profoundly. It was just like, man, this guy loves God more than I do, you know, that type of thing. And so I started going to a self-realization fellowship, which was the church that they have in Phoenix. And I found myself kind of like in a little bit of a conflict. I was following the teachings of Yogananda, and I was participating in the teachings, you know. So then one night I flew back to Northern California. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I have, you know, things happen to me at 4 o'clock in the morning for whatever reason.
Right.
Anyway, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I had this dream about Yogananda. And in the dream, I had visited his ashram one time, so I kind of, you know, knew the layout of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of a curiosity thing, myself and my girlfriend at the time went in and checked it out. But in the dream, I was at the ashram, and the dream had several disjointed components to it, which I don't quite understand. One of them was that there was a stage, and there was this guy dancing on the stage, and he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that has to do with anything whatsoever, but I knew he was gay, and here he is dancing on the stage in the ashram, on the grounds of the ashram. So I kind of like, you know, okay, whatever. I turn away from that, and I go over to the wall of the ashram, and for some reason, I wanted to look over the wall, so I stepped onto something and was able to lift myself up to look over the wall. And on the other side of the wall was like this old, like a 54 Chevy, something like that. It had the trunk lid open. Inside the trunk lid, Yogananda was standing, and he started singing this beautiful, beautiful, angelic, well, it was angelic music. He started singing whatever language he was singing in, I don't know, but in another language. He is Indian. I don't know if it's his, whatever his native language is, or, you know, it is said, I don't know, that the angels have their own language or whatever, you know. All I know, it was a foreign tongue, but it was beautiful. Whatever he was singing was beautiful. And let me step back.
Okay.
Beautiful doesn't touch it. He was singing something, his voice and the music was angelic. It was like nothing that exists on the earth plane. And it was just, I started hearing this thing, and all of a sudden, you know, I wasn't at that wall anymore or anything. It was just like I was standing kind of like before him. And I got hit, every molecule in my body all at one time was hit by this vibration of this highly, highly, highly refined wave of love all at one time. It was just like I got hit by this thing, and I started vibrating at a resonance of love that heretofore before, you know, I've never experienced before that or after that. It was such a high, fine form of love that had they cranked up the frequency one level more, whatever a level is in the angelic realms, it would have killed my physical body. It was all I could do just to hold on for dear life, so to speak, and at the same time absorb this vibration of love that was incredible, just absolutely incredible. And I fell to my knees, and I started crying in the dream. And I kind of like woke up, and I could hear the music. I could hear his voice. Again, I didn't know the words, but I could hear his voice, and I could hear the tone and the music in my head, and I just started crying and crying and crying. And it was to me, I walked away from that experience. And by the way, I picked up my tape recorder and I hummed that tune, and I have lost that tape.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was clearly a message from the other side by somebody who loves us all profoundly. Can't believe I lost the tape. But I don't consider that an accident either. I don't think it was for anybody to have.
Well, it seems like it stayed with you anyway.
Well, I don't remember the tune anymore. The experience will, there's no forgetting it ever. But I wish I, you know, I've tried to remember that tune on a few occasions, and I have not been able to. It's the way it's supposed to be, I guess. Anyway, I called both SRF and Ann Fisher and related the next day and related that dream and the story. And they, interestingly enough, they both said the same thing, which was that, you know, when one is walking a spiritual path, that to walk more than one path may seem confusing and contradictory at times, that I may be better off just choosing one and staying with it. And that created a conflict for me because I really liked the teachings of Yogananda, and I was absolutely smitten with the teachings by Anne, or the channeled teachings that I was on. Mm-hmm. So for a while I struggled with that, and I finally said, fuck this. These are the humans down here talking. And, my heart is absorbing experience and data from both of these teachings at the same time. I'm just going to continue doing it, Whatever contradictions come about, if I can resolve it in my own head or try to get some input, fine. And if I can't, so be it. So be it. It's the way it is. Mm-hmm. So I would say to somebody, if you're told that from now on, acknowledge it and be aware that there's a possibility. And I did in fact encounter a couple of what seemed to be contradictory things from the two teachings. Could never resolve it. Just plain old let it go. And I took all the good that I could from both of them, and they were both filled with nothing but good, which the irony of my ongoing conversation/disagreement with about the Bible with this guy that I'm working with is that while the Bible has some really, really beautiful things in it, it's also got some slanderous statements as far as I'm concerned about God, about being a vindictive being and being a murderer and being this and being that, and that's just not my God. Mm-hmm. Anyone who can touch me with that kind of love doesn't need to destroy a human being because they consider them a threat, or they consider them so evil that they're not worth redeeming, or something like that. That kind of love just doesn't recognize this other thing over here, the two. But this guy, his name is Bill Mack. He hasn't had that experience. So all he's going on is head knowledge and how he feels about the Bible, and more power to him.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually decided that I'm not going to have conversations like that with him anymore. I'm only going to talk about the good things that I know about God, and he can quote a scripture if he wants, and I'm just going to leave it there. Not worth touching. Because he's too made his own leap of faith, and his leap of faith landed squarely on the Bible, and it is, it's completely unshakable. And I didn't even know that I wanted to shake it. I just wanted to kind of like put in a thought, maybe God isn't the killer that you think he is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what will happen with him in the long run. Anyway, I'm letting that go. So here I am, I considered that a divine gift, a divine message, and that I'm literally touched by the hand of God in that dream that night. And so going back to the people who would say, you're all wet with some of this stuff. That's not anything that I can convey, except for having said what I've just said. Once you've had an experience like that, it's really hard to go back to the old ways of being. It's just hard. I personally cannot do it. I don't even try, but all these healings that I underwent continue to change the makeup of the being that I was. So when I think about the guy that I assaulted,
mm-hmm.
Jesus, that must have been a guy in his 60s, and I hit him on the head with a gun, That old mama-san in Vietnam in her 70s, and I whacked her on the head with my helmet. I am so far removed, thank God, from that person. And, while I have regrets, let me put this from another perspective.
Okay.
Recently, I was asked by somebody, you know, what it meant to be healed, because as far as they were concerned, you know, if I talked to them about one of my Vietnam experiences and I would start to cry, I'm not healed as far as they're concerned, you know. And I had to think about that for a while, you know. I mean, what's the difference? What's the difference now? I cried then, I cry now. I actually don't cry as much now as I did back then. Unfortunately, I didn't cry then a whole heck of a lot, but for a whole different reasons. I couldn't even cry. I had to, as a man, I had to learn how to cry, teach myself how to cry, because I was so shut down. And crying, just as a side thing, crying is really an important thing to be able to do, just like eating, sleeping. Cry is an incredible release. And culturally, men are not, still to this day, even though that's changing, are not encouraged to cry. You know, it's like, you know, we're sissies, i.e. that means, you know, homosexual, at least in as I was growing up. And, you know, you don't want to be a homosexual. I mean, heaven forbid. Mm-hmm. No crying. Even when I saw and some of the things that I saw, no crying. You know, no crying for years after Vietnam. Incredible pain, but no crying. So at most, I'd get, you know, a little tear forming at the corner of my eye. That's it. That's what I call crying. I'm still not very good at it, but I'm a lot better than I was. And anyway, long and the short of it is, crying is a good thing, you know? And we're not less men because we cry. And, you know, I've been pretty successful. My son's pretty good at it. He's 31 now. And my daughter, you know, the women seem to have it down. They always have. But it's the men on this plane.
I think this is a good time for us to break for this session.
Yeah, this may be a good point.
Okay.